State Affairs Committee. Please take the roll.
Here.
Representative Sponholz.
She's excused.
Representative Price Tompkins.
Here.
Representative Tallarico.
Here.
Representative Stutes.
Here.
Representative Keller.
Here.
Chair Lynn.
Here. Again, welcome everybody. Hope you had a good Easter. Easter's what it's all about, right? So this morning we have HB 368 to hear and HB 24. And on, if the presenter of HB 368 would come forward, please. And we have a CS to adopt on this. And I'll let one of you folks, the sponsors, explain what the CS is. And as a matter of information, I checked with the sponsor, and she did not wish to move this bill out of committee today. It's kind of an exposition of some, maybe some very good ideas, and I'll let her explain that. Then we do have the CS. So you, would you just go through the CS just a little bit, then we'll adopt that, and then we'll go ahead with the with your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
One moment, please. Yes.
Just a question. Is that version W that she's going to be explaining?
I don't know.
Yes.
What version is it?
W.
W, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Shelley Hughes, representative from District 11. Palmer, good to see you this morning. Mr. Chair, I was prepared to give a general overview.
Right.
Would it be all right? Because I think that would still be foundational, and then if you wanted technical things before adopting the CS, I can hand it over to Ginger.
Well, either way, it doesn't. Whichever way you want, it doesn't matter as long as we adopt the CS.
Okay.
You know, at some point, right?
Right.
Okay. Please continue.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, because it is not—it's not a particularly brief bill, and it covers a lot of ground.
I will point. There will not be public testimony on this bill since we're not moving in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, when you think about our fiscal challenge, we all know we have to make changes in this state, and we can make them through the operating budget, but then there's certain things we can't do unless we change statutes, and really that's what this is about. It's providing tools that are missing from the administration's toolbox. That's what this does in a nutshell. And the state government has to be managed, and the administration manages it, and there are certain basic principles in management. And those three are the three-legged stool: time, resources, and scope.
Yeah, and I hate to interrupt, but you need to identify yourself. I'm sorry.
Oh, I did, but I will again. I'm Shelley Hughes, District 11, Palmer.
We're impressed, obviously.
Yes, we're listening so intensely.
You want to make sure people know where you're from.
Okay, yeah, Palmer. So when you think of these three basic things, you know, every good project, a successful project, a great project actually is going to be completed on or before the allowed time, on or under budget, and that will meet or exceed the required scope. And so when we think of scope with what we're facing as legislators, we're thinking about the size of government. And when we think about time, we're thinking, oh my, we have this challenge, and we've got so much time to address it before we'd have to completely shut down essential services. And then the resources would be the people. And when we think about the people, if you remove the formula spending and what's left, about half of that has to do with human resources. And so much of this bill addresses that and would give tools to the administration as far as bringing down costs. And as we brainstormed, and I brainstormed with different colleagues and with my staff, different things we can do, we had a big long list, and some of those things we didn't put in this bill. They didn't fit under the title, but we're proposing these to get the conversation started for the legislature. So we looked at a retirement incentive program. We looked at restriction on upper management positions. We looked at statutory health care contributions shared by the employee. We looked at furlough options. We looked at, which some of these things Ginger will explain, the personal service line item. And we looked at efficiency incentives for employees, and we also looked at tying up paper reduction, which has been done in the past, but this would really kind of close that so we wouldn't have to keep revisiting it. And so what this bill is doing is looking at the resources in respect to the time and scope that faces us. And so there are tax bills out there to increase revenue, and there are some, but relatively few proposals that would bring savings, and this is one of them. And it's a starting point to reduce spending in the area of human resources. And back to that project management methodology, the scope, we want to reduce the size of government. Two, we want to look at the budget, reduce the size of the budget. And number three, in the time allotted, we want to get her done so that we can continue to provide those essential services that we're obligated to provide to the people of Alaska based on our state constitution. And so with that, that's just a general overview. And my staff, Ginger, can talk about the technical aspects and how you want to do that before you adopt the CS. And I actually have another committee meeting, so I'm going to stick around for a little bit while she gets started, and then I will slip out, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Please introduce yourself.
For the record, my name is Ginger Blaisdell, and I'm staff to Representative Hughes.
Thank you.
Please and give the presentation. Sure. The changes between version A and version W are two additional, I guess you would call them programs. One of them addresses furlough, and one of them addresses the transfers out of the personal services line in the budget.
What was the last one?
Transfers out of or into the personal services line in the budget. So those are the two additional provisions that were added to HB 368 to get to version W. Do you want to talk about the bill, or do you want to adopt version W to discuss first, or what order?
Makes no difference to me. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'd move LS-1476, version W whiskey of the CS for House Bill 368 for the working copy for explanation in the committee.
Fine. Do we have an objection for discussion?
I'll object for discussion.
Please continue.
Thank you. The order in which the bill is organized is by statutory number order, and so some of the programs have sections that are in a variety of places throughout the bill. So the section analysis basically highlights the seven areas that we're looking at statutory changes in order to provide new management tools to the administration. The first one is paper reduction. The Paper Reduction Act basically requires that state agencies provide their statutorily required reports electronically, but provides five copies to the state distribution center, the library distribution center. And you can see the paper reduction section is on section 2, section 3, section 15, and 16. And so that would just be a cost savings, reducing paper. There was a memo from Ledge Legal that described that the paper reduction section of this bill probably would not fit under the Single Subject Act, but this is one of the management tools we were hoping to offer to the governor for savings. The second part is state employee furlough. This would be a mandatory furlough, and in this bill, we highlight 10 days or 80 hours, and certainly the number of days or hours would be subject to the committee's recommendations.
And I'll make a comment here, if I could, Mr. Chair, in that that because I believe that we're looking for exempt employees of a five-day furlough, that might be something that the legislature might want to adjust that 10 to 5.
Okay.
We started on this earlier before we knew it was going to be 5 for the others. Thank you.
So under the state employee furlough, currently state statute only allows for employees that fall under the State Personnel Act, which are mostly exempt and partially exempt employees. So only those folks would be required to take furlough days. Section 4 of this act would include furlough as not subject to collective bargaining. And as union contracts are renegotiated, the prohibition for furlough would not be part of the contracts. Right now, many contracts say you cannot furlough. Section 8 includes new furlough language to the compensation allowance and leave section for state employees except specific employee groups listed. So this would eventually not be allowed in collective bargaining to prohibit furlough of those employees. The third section is the personal services line item. And right now in a budget, they're called objects of expenditures. It's personal services, travel, contractual or professional services, commodities, grants, and miscellaneous. When we looked at the overall cost for personal services for the state of Alaska, just the operating budget, once you remove formula programs, which is primarily foundation funding and Medicaid, just slightly more than 50% of all the costs go to personal services.
If you could just like to recognize Representative Sponholt, has not joined us. Please continue.
And I'd just like to make a comment just for clarification, because I saw someone looking down at the bill. She said the third section, but actually this is section 5. This is the third area that we're addressing.
Third area,
clarification.
Okay.
Yes, sorry. So it's actually section 5 and section 6. So what brought this particular topic to light was looking at an OMB report that comes out twice a year, and it is moving, they have to report moving into or out of the personal services line item in a budget. And for the last fiscal year report that they provided, it was $29 million that were moved out of personal services to other line items. So that is funding that the legislature provided through personal services, expecting that to pay for employees. And it was used in other areas. Could have been for travel, could have been for purchasing commodities, who knows, a wide variety of things.
And I'll make a comment. This is Shelley Hughes for purposes of the record, since we have two female voices here, that just as an example, because this was something that Ginger brought to me, and it was like, well, how does this work? Someone's in a positions funded, person leaves 4 months after the year begins, 8 months of that salary is left remaining. They decide not to fill that position for one reason or another, so they can take that money and use it elsewhere. So this would not allow that to happen. Thank you.
Okay, please continue and identify yourself again.
Yes, Ginger Blaisdell, staff to Representative Hughes. The other thing that restricting transfers into or out of the personal services line would do is that it would, when the legislature asks for an unallocated reduction in personal services, in this instance, that reduction would actually occur in the personal services line. As it is now, if the legislature were to say a reduction of 10% unallocated, it could be in any line, and that money could be moved for any purpose throughout the year. IRIS, the new accounting system, will track personal services. It will track line item by fund source, and it will start doing that in November. And so there shouldn't be an issue with trying to redistribute the correct funding for each position. But in the event there is an issue with tracking specific fund sources for positions, LBNA can probably resolve quite a bit of that by having departments come to them, asking them to reallocate some of their fund sources. with the exception of general funds. And that might have to come in a supplemental if it were needed. All right. The next program is fairly simple. This one is reducing the number of special assistants in the commissioner's office. So Section 9, 10, and 11 in the bill simply reduce from up to two special assistants to one special assistant per state agency.
Repeat that last part, please. It would reduce what?
It would reduce the number of special assistants to the commissioner from two to one special assistant per state agency.
The definition of special assistants.
Yes. Would that be, and that be across the board or just?
No, because it doesn't have this in there.
The reduction, would that be across the board or?
Yes, sir.
In every department, whatever.
Yes, for the record, this is Ginger Blaisdell, Chairman. It would be across the board. Some departments only have one special assistant. Some may have two, but this would restrict only one per agency.
Okay. Thank you.
The next piece that we were looking at is sort of an efficiency incentive program. And this was brought out, I think it was actually brought out in one of the agency finance subcommittee hearings, where there is no incentive for an employee to come up with maybe an outstanding way to save money or save time or make a process better. And so Section 12 and Section 14 would allow the governor to establish some sort of an efficiency program where a state employee could be actually rewarded for coming up with a great idea. It could be something as small as getting a lapel pin and a recognition certificate. It could be something that would allow them to have maybe a merit increase for 3 months, maybe a year, but there could be a cash reward, there could be just a pin, but it allows the governor to actually recognize some of those outstanding employees.
We actually had a program similar to that in the Air Force, and it was fairly successful.
Great. And Chairman, through one of the finance subcommittees, there is one agency who has been able to recognize those employees that have been doing something outstanding, and they recognize them in our subcommittee hearings. They were part of the presentation, and they were also given just a small token, a small gift from the department. So some agencies have found a way to do that, but this would really give some specific recognition.
Oh, Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Which agency was that?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, the Department of Transportation purchases a Carhartt jacket for some of their employees who do outstanding or give outstanding recommendations that show either improvements to business or cash savings.
Thank you. Follow up.
The next program is health care contribution, and this one is Section 13 in the bill. And in the health care contribution, it would be to those state employees who are covered under the State Personnel Act. Right now, those are the exempt and PX employees. But it would require them to pay 20% of their health care coverage, and the state would cover the other 80%. This does not reach into bargaining unit contracts. Those are all items that would have to go into the negotiations. Let's see if this is the last one. Yes. So the last part of the bill, which is the most significant part of the bill, paper-wise, beginning on Section 17 on page 12, is the retirement incentive program. And I know from the number of calls our office has received to see if we were going to have a bill hearing, and they've mentioned they've been calling other offices to find out if a RIP bill, which is what Retirement Incentive Program stands for, to ask if that would be going through. The RIP is a management tool that could be offered. It's not a mandatory offering, but it could be offered to incentivize employees who are within 3 years of their normal retirement date to retire early, thereby leaving a position vacant, filling it with an employee that would enter at a lower step, and saving the state money. The RIP would require an agency to offer a specific window of opportunity by which its qualified employees could apply for a RIP. For purpose of this example, say a department would offer this opportunity between July 1 and September 30.
The term RIF in the military has a very, very bad connotation. I think it's probably different here.
Yes. RIP is Retirement Incentive Program.
And in the military, reduction in force, I believe. And everybody feared a RIF.
Oh, yeah. No F. Right? Mm-hmm. So in this particular program, an employee who is within 3 years of their normal retirement date could apply to the commissioner of that agency between July and September when they opened that that window. Those individual employee applications would be sent to an actuary to determine the savings, if any, that the state would achieve by approving early retirement. So an actuary is actually going to look at the individual's birth date, their retirement date, what range and step they're at, and the intent of the department, whether they were going to fill it, leave it vacant, or delete the position. So an actuary, neutral person, is going to decide whether the state saves money.
Have you had any informal support or opposition to that? Informal?
Support for a RIP program?
Yes. In any opposition, many groups, or support from any groups? Not formal, because we haven't had a hearing.
Right. Through the chair, I have not had anything... any groups specifically say they were for or against. I have had a number of employees who may qualify under this who would be very
interested
in applying to retire early. But I have not heard from any groups.
Okay, thank you. Continue.
The commissioner would consider whether the position would be filled immediately, delete it, leave it vacant, reclassify it. The commissioner could determine what to do after an employee was determined eligible to retire early. If the employee is approved for the early retirement incentive, the employee would have a specific period of time by which they need to retire, or the application process would have to begin again, and that period may have already passed. So typically within 60 days of the actuary's report, that employee would then have to terminate state service or retire.
And there would be some kind of a bonus of some kind, of some amount, to that employee should he or she decide to retire early, correct?
Through the chair, there is no bonus that's provided. I guess the bonus would not have to show up to work at 8 a.m. every morning, Monday through Friday. What the employee would then begin to receive is their actual pension based on time earned, so they wouldn't get additional years added to their service. It would just be based on time earned, and their health care coverage would then begin.
Do not some organizations offer a small bonus of some kind to retire early? Would that throw off the math? Or, I don't mean the full thing, but some bonus to retire early.
Chairman Lynn,
I'm going to get their regular retirement pay.
Right. I'm unaware of anybody who offers an additional bonus incentive like that.
You might check into that.
Okay. The state of Alaska has offered three retirement incentive programs. One was in the 1980s, one was in 1996, and then there was legislation introduced in the early 2000 or mid to right before 2010, and that bill did not pass. So this would possibly be like the third one if it were to pass. The 1996 RIP did have an audit performed by Legislative Budget and Audit, They only looked at two specific employee groups. One of them was the University of Alaska, and the University of Alaska identified 784 employees that would have been eligible to retire early, of which only 377 participated. So not everybody wants to leave state service early. Of the 377 who retired early, the University of Alaska reported $17.8 million in savings. The actual savings that are realized are a little bit unknown because 140 of those who retired early returned to work as part-time employees. So there may have been a little bit skewed, but probably not the full $17.8 million savings. So there is potential for savings. The second group that was audited was ITG, which is Information Technology Group. Now they're called ETS. They're a small unit in the Department of Administration. ITG had 27 employees eligible, 14 elected to retire early, and ITG reported a savings of $1.2 million. So those 14 people saved over $1 million.
And they did not come back part-time.
Correct. Those people separated state service or retired, and the Information Technology Group did choose to leave those positions vacant for the remainder of that year before they rehired again. So there were some savings there. I looked at the Workforce Profile 2015, which is an annual report that the Division of Personnel puts out. And total employees in the retirement and benefit system are 15,576. Those identified as having less than 1 year to retire, 1,960. Those between 1 and 5 years to retire is 1,502. That equated to approximately 22% of current employees would likely be eligible to participate in an early retirement incentive.
Question, Vice Chair Keller.
Yeah, I'm just slow this morning. I would have thought the second number would be bigger. Those within a year, you said, did I miss the numbers?
Less than 1 year to retire, 1,960. And those between 1 and 5 years to retire, 1,502.
Oh, that's on top of what I understand now.
Thank you.
Okay.
I just didn't listen well. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
Sure.
Anybody else? Okay, go ahead, please. Thank you, Abbott Interviews.
So that is a summary of the bill, and I am available for any questions. And again, these are all statutory changes that would be required to offer management tools to the administration to offer ways of saving money or being able to manage employees a little bit differently.
Any questions from the committee? Reverend Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. Big bill, lots of different disparate components. I had a couple of questions in all sorts of aspects. First off, I recall there being, I'm just trying to think, in the last year, sort of austerity measures that the state of Alaska has taken, there's been talk of furlough, and I think furlough executed in certain circumstances. Can you just give us a sense of the landscape right now about what kind of furlough programs have already been implemented and how, as our sort of baseline reference point relative to what this bill would affect?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, the only program that I know that was implemented on furlough can occur to those employees that are covered under the State Employee Act. Those are exempt and PX employees. So the furlough that was asked, I know of one agency that did ask their members to take a furlough, and I believe they took 2 days this fall. Primarily, the Department of Law has almost all exempt or PX employees. In every state agency, your commissioner's office staff, directors are going to be exempt or PX, and the legislature, exempt or PX. The administration doesn't ask us to furlough. We would have to furlough ourselves. The courts are exempt or PX, so they would have to initiate that on their own, and the university would initiate it on their own. Almost all other employees of the state are covered by collective bargaining, and they would not be eligible to furlough unless their bargaining contract stated they would be.
Follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. On the special assistance section, I noted that deputy commissioners are defined as special assistants, which perhaps is already in the statute. I wasn't aware of that definition, and so I immediately thought of a few departments that have two deputy commissioners or a deputy commissioner and a special assistant. And I guess at first blush, it strikes me as sort of tying the hands of agencies that are big and have complex responsibilities and need the ability to have high-level management, DNR, for instance, which is being tasked by us and by the governor with executing AKLNG, and you take away the ability for them to have a high-level person working at the side of the commissioner on a project of that complexity. You're asking them to do a project and then taking away their ability to do it. So it's just sort of a first blush concern. I guess my question is, which agencies would be affected by that statutory language? Have you spoken with them? And why not approach reduction in special assistance through the budget process?
Through the chair and Representative Price Tompkins. The first part of your question of which agencies have more than one deputy commissioner, when I started looking at that, it was a little bit more complex than what I realized, because agencies now have deputy commissioners, assistant commissioners, who also act as directors in some divisions. Almost every department has two or more deputy commissioners and maybe some assistants. So it was a wide variety. Yes, they all do have important roles, but the constituency that's been calling Representative Hughes' office has been asking over and over again to reduce the level of upper management positions, and those do tend to stand out, and they are created in statute. And so we're changing the statutory requirement to reduce that upper-level management. What was the second part of the question again?
There was a part of the question about why not approach these reductions through the budget process?
Through the chair, Representative Price Tompkins. Again, the budget process, the legislature appropriates funds. It does not appropriate positions. And so you could take a reduction of a dollar amount equal to an individual's salary, and you could say it goes to this PCN number, but in the end, the agency can decide whether they want to keep that position and spread the reduction elsewhere or manage it differently. So that's just not an option that's available to specifically reduce a position through the budget.
Go ahead.
Is the allocation that exists for commissioners' office level budget reductions not specific enough for that purpose?
Through the chair, a budget reduction is monetary only. It does not require the agency to actually remove that specific position.
One more?
Yeah. I've got a lot of questions. I guess just on that particular point, I was on the DNR Finance Subcommittee, and we made a commissioner's office level budget reduction that I was personally had to pause with. But point being that you can allocate reductions to the commissioner's office. It's not specific to a PCN, but it does sort of have that targeted and more surgical effect. You're ultimately leaving it to the commissioner's office to figure out where they can cut most easily. It was just sort of fresh in my mind from this most recent budget process. I guess my last question on this line of questions is, I'm noting on page 5, lines 30 and 31, I didn't realize this was in law until this bill came across, that there's actually a statute that says you can't have more than two special assistants in the commissioner's office of a principal department of the executive branch. And I just noted in your response earlier, you mentioned that some of these departments have more than two, at least in your sort of initial research, and so that would seem to be contrary to existing statute. and wondering how that reconciles out, or if you've brought that to the attention of anyone.
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, more than two were the deputy commissioners or assistant commissioners. I don't know of any department that has more than two special assistants.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Yes.
Just to follow up on that, I would have presumed that you didn't find a definition for special assistant. and I really appreciate you bringing this up, and it occurs to me that there's definitions that maybe we ought to consider, and that's why I appreciate you bringing it up. But deputy commissioners, what are they, their job description, how specific can we get, and those kind of things. So good questions you're raising. But
Through the chair, Representative Keller, in section 3925.120, they talk about all of the positions that are included in the partially exempt service, so a PX employee. There's about 38 different ones in here. I'm just looking real quick to make sure that it says what the definition is. It just says not more than two special assistants. Under 29.130, let me look at that one real quick. It doesn't have a definition of special assistant, but that is a specific job class code. So when you employ a person, everyone has a specific job class code. And special assistant to the commissioner 1 and 2 are two salary range differences, but a department could choose one special assistant.
Follow up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I assume that we want just the questions on the table that we may have,
yes,
and want to,
yeah,
work out with a sponsor. It isn't that we're debating here at all.
No, we're not debating because we're not going to pass this bill today.
Right.
And I think we said earlier we're going to look at this over the interim.
I want to put a flag on page 3, line 29, where it talks about, it uses the terminology leave. I'm not an attorney. I do not know if there's definitions or whatever, but in my understanding, leave implies with pay, and it uses in the same sentence with furlough, so it's more a drafting question of whether that accomplishes what the sponsor wants. And I just, again, you don't need to respond. I just wanted to throw that on the record as a consideration. The other question I have is back on page 2, line 9. If you explain why you went from 4 to 5 copies in the library, I missed it. So why are we going to 5? I think I know, but I just would appreciate you responding.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, the change from 4 to 5 copies is that no other printed copies would be made available to the public or to others who ask. And the Publication Distribution Center felt that 5 would be more adequate. So 5 copies, and the rest would be electronic.
Thank you. Thank you. And the DNR, of course, that's, you know, what little money we have nowadays still comes from, natural resources. And so, and of course, Department of Public Safety keeps us all safe as well as they can. Would that, the reduction include those folks also, public safety and DNR?
Representative Lynn, are you talking about the furlough reduction?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm not. I'm talking about a reduction in deputy commissioners.
Yes, through the chair. Yes, the reduction would also include the Department of Public Safety. They would have one commissioner, one deputy commissioner. They do have a variety of directors. And so those directors, can certainly have oversight and direct contact to the deputy and commissioner of that agency.
Same with DNR.
Yes, sir.
Because all these projects, we're trying to put together, including the gas pipeline, someday, I hope, Mm-hmm. All just reduced down. Mm-hmm. Just, I know it's rather simplistic, but sometimes I just wonder, why don't we just assign a certain amount of money to a department and let them figure out who they have and who they hire. And maybe to the governor, you got this amount of money, now hire as many or as few as you want to with this amount of money. It's up to you because you're the manager. And we're not, you know, not micromanage. You have two of this and one of that and three of that. It would seem to me to be up to the commissioner and or the governor. It just, you know, again, that's simplistic, I realize. Yeah. Representative Stonehouse.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I learned this morning that Juneau does have traffic.
Juneau does
have traffic. Yeah,
yeah, right. And rain along with the traffic.
Yes, yes. All right. So, through the chair, I actually had a question sort of along the line of the deputy and special commissioners, and you may not be able to answer this today, I understand, but it was, I was sort of thinking a bit along the lines of Chair Lynn and Representative Christ Tonkins in sort of wanting to understand sort of what the rationale is a little bit more. I heard you say that people call into the office expressing concern about bloated, you know, upper management, but we also know that that there's a lot of research that's been done in best management practices and some of the projects that we're asking the commissioners and their teams to do are pretty extensive, and I'd like to hear a little bit more, get a little more information about sort of what the rationale would be for such a very specific number. It concerns me that we might be hamstringing, you know, tying the hands of some of the managers and actually limiting their ability to deliver on some of the things that we're asking them to do. So maybe you could do a little more research into what the implications of that might be for some of the bigger departments in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could certainly do that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Your comment?
Through the chair, the only remarks that I would have is that we were called by numerous individuals, and there has been discussion amongst other members of the body that wanted to reduce upper management. And this was one tool that might be an option to reduce upper management.
I see. I think this is very good what you've done here. We have, you know, several potential ideas to, you know, to cut the budget, which we all need to do surgically, not with a meat axe. And I want to thank you for bringing this before us. Reverend Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. Thank you.
I wasn't going to adjourn until after you spoke there.
A few more questions, and again, in the spirit of Representative Keller's comment, and this is a Gruenberg-esque observation, perhaps, but...
Is that going to be long or short?
Hopefully short, but,
okay.
But
then it's not
very
a Gruenberg.
Specific. Okay, fair enough. In Section 14, 4419018B, I just wanted to...
Page?
Maybe note, especially if this is going to be page worked eight on over the interim, the use of shall versus may, and in Section A it talks about the governor may award a pin, and then Section B it talks about how the governor shall make arrangements for the pin, and just wondering if there might be sort of an interest in having parallelism. Again, just a sort of constructive observation that may be worth nothing. But a much broader question. The section about healthcare costs and employee contributions, that seems to have, I would guess, just titanic sort of fiscal implications. And do you have a sense of, if we adopted that right now, what kind of cost shifting that would result in, both savings to the state and then just ballpark what an employee would be paying per month, 80% of his or her healthcare contributions, what that number looks like?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins. So real quickly on the efficiency incentive program, what we were hoping is that the governor shall implement a program, but he would have the option of doing a PIN or awarding some kind of a merit increase or, you know, some kind of cash award. So there is some options for the governor to consider how to incentivize employees. And so maybe the terminology needs to be corrected to change that.
But it's just a drafting observation.
Right.
Yeah.
And then your second question about the cost implications of changing the contribution basis to our health care costs. I don't know if that would be retirement benefits or personnel, but both there are representatives from the Department of Administration that might be able to talk to that. I don't believe they've had an opportunity to fully vet the fiscal impact, so we don't have a fiscal note on that just yet.
Okay. Governor Vasquez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That dovetails to my question. There is a fiscal note I see, OMB component number 58. This doesn't seem to be a date, maybe 3/25/16. According to this, what's the expenditure or savings?
I don't know if there's someone from the department that would like to speak to this.
We do have.
Yes, Chair.
Mr. Chair, if you like, on the record here, we have somebody from Personnel, Labor, and Relations, Kate Sheehan's in the room for questions.
That would be invited testimony, not public, right?
Right.
Yes. That person in the room, please.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Before we proceed, I had a question of Mrs. Blaisdell.
Yes, go ahead.
Did you identify in dollar terms how much this bill can potentially save the state?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez. No, I've not quantified an actual dollar savings. When I looked historically, the retirement incentive program could possibly save the state of Alaska a significant amount. It gives the opportunity for school districts, municipalities, any public entity to offer a retirement incentive program, as well as the state and the university. The big caveat in that is that not every person who might be eligible may want to retire. They may love their job and want to stay. Some divisions don't have to offer the retirement incentive program, even though it's out there. An example could be a school district who spends, say, $100,000 in recruiting a new superintendent. If that school district were to offer the RIP and their superintendent goes away, it could be a very expensive replacement cost, and maybe the actuary would take that into consideration. But the actuary is really going to tell you which individuals, if they were to retire early, would create a cost savings. When I looked at the audit from 1996, it looks very promising to save a lot of money for the state of Alaska, just because of those savings that were indicated in two groups.
So obviously there's a lot of unknowns.
A lot of unknowns.
Any Vasquez following?
Yes. With regard to the RIP, for the record, the Retirement Incentive Program, was there any thoughts in also prohibiting any issuance of contracts for individuals that decide to take the RIP? In other words, there is the possibility of having an employee going through the RIP but just turning around and being hired through a contract by the department or division.
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, I think the term that kind of got coined by that was retire, rehire. And there are, I think, two different approaches to that. One is that an employee who works for the state under contract, whether they're retired from the state or otherwise, if they're a contractor, they provide their own health care. They provide, they pay their own taxes, you know, federal taxes. They pay, they have to pay all of their own administrative overhead. There might be an option, a benefit to the state where they would save money. The state could also rehire an individual for them to come back for a very limited scope of time, maybe to train a replacement or some kind of seasonal work. So there might be a benefit to that. The morale question that usually comes in with the kind of that coined phrase of retire, rehire, is that when an individual retires and they're collecting their retirement wages, and they're covered by health care. And then they come back and they take the same position in a state agency that they apparently just left. The morale issue is that those individuals who might otherwise have been encouraged to apply and maybe be promoted into a new position would not have that opportunity. And so that kind of stifles the morale. That's a completely different question than would the state save money by retiring people early? The morale issue is an administrative consideration. If you put two pieces of this together, if you put a no transfer to and from the personal services line and you do a retirement incentive, it becomes very difficult to replace your employees with somebody out of the contractual services line, because now you can't shift that money from personal services to contractual. And so it could eliminate some of that morale issue.
Okay, one more.
By the way, that morale issue is more complex because a lot of other employees will see that as double dipping, which is deeply, deeply resented. Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
The same question applies to rehiring these individuals after taking a RIP, rehiring them as part-time employees. So I guess the same issues arise from not just contracts, but part-time employment. Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
The section about limiting departments to one special assistant, I think that could work well with smaller departments, but I don't think that is really feasible for the larger departments. For instance, the Department of Health and Social Services that have over 3,000 employees. It's a big, big department, and I was in that department. It would be really hard to have just the commissioner and one other deputy commissioner or assistant commissioner. It would be hard because I think the department has about 5-6 divisions. So it would be difficult for the two largest departments, I think.
Okay, I'd like to ask, is Kate Sheehan in the room?
Yes.
Please come forward and make whatever comments you'd like to make. Identify yourself, obviously.
For the record, my name is Kate Sheehan, and I'm Director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations. Excuse me. I don't have any comments, but I am available for questions if there are any.
Okay, any questions for her? Representative Vasquez.
Ms. Sheehan, do you see the fiscal note that was prepared for this bill?
Yes.
And according to this, what will it cost? What will it save?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, what this is right here is if the governor were to award an extra merit step or pay increment to an employee, and they did 5 total each year, this is what the cost would be.
Go ahead.
So this particular fiscal note is just focused on one feature of this bill. Why weren't the other features not considered?
Through the chair, my understanding is that Office of Management and Budget is working on a fiscal note.
Okay, thank you.
And, Mr. Chairman, for the record, which fiscal note are we referring to? There's an OMB component number. The one I'm looking at is 58, and it seems to be a date of 3/25/16.
Through the chair, yes. That's the fiscal note that is just representing the 5 employees that could get the extra merit step.
Thank you.
And thank you. Reverend Keller.
Yeah, it has already come up. I just want to make clear because we have Kathy Lee here in retirement benefits, and she may want to add something.
Sure.
Yeah, but the 80% thing on the projected cost of health care, has that been analyzed, or is that something part of the OMB analysis that's looking forward to?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I'm not sure. That has not been analyzed by the Division of Personnel, and I don't know if it's part of the OMB analysis.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Is Kathy Lee here, please? Mm-hmm. Good morning, Ms. Lee. Please identify yourself and your position.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Kathy Lee. My last name is spelled L-E-A. I am the Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement Benefits.
Uh-huh. Okay. I won't be talking to you for a long time.
Okay.
This is a matter of information. Any questions you'd like to add? Anybody in the committee would like to ask her? Representative Kreis Tompkins.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. I wonder if my previous question about health care costs and employee contributions, if you might have a sense of what 80% of an employee's health care contributions might pencil out to be, and what kind of ballpark fiscal savings might come about from that kind of statutory change.
Through the chair, Representative Kreis Tompkins, the division is developing its fiscal notes for this bill. We have an actuarial fiscal note for the RIP in process. We also have an analysis on the health cost and savings in process, and we should have those by early next week.
Any follow-up?
Just a follow-up. Do you have a ballpark sense of what 80% of health care costs for a state employee is?
Through the chair, Representative Kreis Tompkins, I'm the pension person.
Oh, excuse me. Okay.
So, no, I don't have the health cost information at the tip of my fingers.
A follow-up?
Go ahead.
Forgive my ignorance on sort of where benefits, retirements, all that landscape works out. Is there someone at the state that would have a sense of that number and be familiar with a health care plan?
Through the chair, yes, that would be Michelle Michaud. She is the chief health official.
Is she in the room?
No, but I would like to comment on that. The language of the bill is that the commissioner would have to come up with a number. So it is, I'm sure that somebody has a sense of it and can give us some input, but it's a new requirement to project what the health care costs might be and then 80% based on that. So it's not a gotcha type question. I just wanted to put that on the record.
Of course, this one where we're just exploring this very broad area we've talked about this morning. I don't know if we have to get down to dollars and cents on everything.
Mm-hmm. Chairman and Representative Kreis Tompkins, the last bargaining unit contract, that I've been reading a number of them to see what provisions are included or not included, and one of them offered that the state would pay for, it was between $1,300 and $1,400 per person for health care. So if you took 80% of, say, $1,300, that's probably what the employee would be paying. That said, that's the employee's health insurance. Once you add a premium plan or you add family or you add some other things on top of that, it does get a little bit more expensive. Those are all optional and choice programs, but they would still pay 20% of that. So.
Thank you. You just scratched the itch of my curiosity.
Okay, since we're not going to move this bill today, could you give kind of a very brief, broad review of what you said here and what we're going to be doing with this,
Mr. Chair?
After comments from Vice Chair Keller.
We missed Representative Grinberg, you know. Yeah, Mr. Chair. There is one other question that I would like to ask the sponsor's representative while she's here, because I think it's an important one. On page 11, down on
thank you, Ms. Lee.
Line 15 through 18, it talks about electronic distribution prevailing, and that's something we all want to do, but where it includes the words on line 17 will present a report. What came to my mind was that there are times when committees are going to want first-hand reports. And so if we were going to move the bill today, I would suggest an amendment that said except, upon request of the standing committee in the legislature, something like that. And I just wanted to put that thought on them. She doesn't have to respond, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to write.
Mr. Chair?
And, yes, Representative Sponholz.
I had a request that could be addressed at a later date, but if we're considering WIPs, then we know that there's going to be some costs that will be shifted over to retirement. I understand it's I think that retirement comes from sort of a separate pot, but since we're responsible for the whole thing, I'd like to ask that we get the information about what the total implication is, even if it wouldn't be coming from the department, just so we can be honest with ourselves about the total cost of offering RIPS. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now let me see if I understand that correct. You presented it's a very good bill that you've presented. It would be difficult to pass, of course, because it covers so many different areas. And what is your plan over the interim on this, if it's possible? Are you going to perhaps introduce some legislation on the different areas of this, if it's possible for you to do that in January? Where are we going from here? Because this has been a very good discussion, very eye-opening discussion.
Chairman Lynn, and respectfully on behalf of Representative Hughes, who's not here to talk to that, the reason that this bill was drafted with so many moving parts is because these were all monetary, possibilities to find some monetary savings for the state of Alaska, but they all required statutory change that could not be done just through the appropriation process. And so this kind of omnibus budget bill, whatever you want to call it, was brought forth just to get some of the conversation started. Some of these parts might fit well into other pieces of legislation. They might be standalone legislation. We're basically very open to whatever the legislature would like to use, any of it, all of it, bits and pieces. But these are statutory changes that would be required in order to give the administration more management tools to save money.
Thank you very much. I think it's very well done. It's been a very good presentation this morning. Thanks to you and Representative Hughes for bringing this. We'll just take a short break, and then we go to the next bill. House State Affairs Committee will please come back to order. Next on the agenda is HB 24, and I'd like to welcome Representative Tito here from the State Affairs Committee. Please give us your name, of course I just did, and tell us about this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sam Keto. I'm the representative for District 33, downtown Juneau, Douglas Island, Skagway, Haynes, Cluckwan, Gustavus, and Excursion Inlet. And thank you very much for hearing House Bill 24. So House Bill 24, which you have before you today, basically requires that a municipality that receives funding from the state, state funding for a construction project, for the design component of those projects is required to utilize qualifications-based selection in selecting a design professional, which
would you define qualification-based as compared to whatever it is now?
Certainly. So actually there are quite a few municipalities already that require qualifications-based selection, so they are already doing this. But the qualifications-based selection for a design professional means that when you're hiring an architect, an engineer, a land surveyor, landscape architect, that you're asking for requests for proposals based on the individual or the firm's qualifications, as opposed to the price of those services. And one of the key components really that drives this, so if we take a step back nationally in Congress, there's an act called the Brooks Act. The Brooks Act requires that federal procurement for design professionals utilize qualifications-based selection. In the state of Alaska, we also have a mini Brooks Act, which requires that state-funded projects require qualifications-based selection, so it's already being used with DOT for construction of projects in the state of Alaska.
Oh, let's see if I got this in my head. So qualifications-based means that you have a record and certain professional qualifications in your new field, and you can look at that to procure, or you can go by price only. Is that correct?
So,
Michigan.
Mr. Chairman, and this bill actually requires that qualifications be the selection factor for design services for projects that are funded by the state of Alaska. And basically what that means is, so I myself am an engineer, and I've put proposals in on projects. Those proposals are based on the work that I've done in the past and the quality of the work that I've done in the past, as opposed to the price that I've charged for that work. So most engineers will charge an hourly rate fairly similar, but the qualifications will be quite a bit different. So while I'm a civil engineer, and while technically I might be qualified to do, say, a building foundation, my expertise is in coastal and transportation engineering. If I am bidding on a project, they're going to be looking at my coastal and transportation engineering experience. And if it's a project that doesn't involve coastal or transportation engineering, I may still be able to do it, but it might take me two or three times as long and cost quite a bit more. So what we're saying, what the bill says, is that if you are hiring somebody, an architect, so I think if you're looking at architects perhaps for building houses or building large state buildings, there are many architects that specialize in doing residential construction. Those might not necessarily be the architects that you would want bidding on a project to design a new state office building, because the skills are quite a bit different. And so what this building says is, if we as a state are providing money to a municipality for a capital project, that when they are looking at trying to have that project designed, that they look at the qualifications of those individuals that are proposing on the project.
Would that not be in the RFP? Say, the City of Juneau wants to build a building someplace, and they're looking for proposals. Would they not put both, you know, qualification in this type of construction as well as a price?
Mr. Chairman, not necessarily, although it does happen at times. And so the not necessarily is, if I am looking at a project and I know my construction budget is, say, $100 million, typically the design components of that project will be from 4 to 8% of the cost of the project. So I know what my budget is for design. And if I end up wanting to try and build a Taj Mahal, a very complex structure, those costs could be higher. But for an average building, there is a range of construction costs that the design will cost. So what if I'm an owner and I'm wanting to build a facility, I budget for that 6 to 8%. And then when I negotiate with a designer and talk to the designer about what I would like to see for that facility, then the designer comes back and says, well, after you've actually selected the designer that has the best qualifications, you start negotiating on the price. And if they come back and say, well, that's going to cost 20% of your, I might have to think about what my design is looking like and what I want to actually do with the facility. And so as an owner, I still have complete control over the design cost of the project. The design cost of the project is not going to be 50, 40, 30, 20% of a project, but it could range maybe up as high as 10 or 12% depending on what kinds of complexity there are in the design.
I see. I believe you came in and talked to me before you join us in as a representative about this issue, as I recall.
Mr. Chairman, I have actually worked actively with a group called the Alaska Professional Design Council.
I see.
And the Alaska Professional Design Council being a collaboration of various design entities, including the American Society of Civil Engineers, the Alaska Society of Professional Engineers, the American Engineering Consulting Engineering Council, land surveyors. There are many design groups that get together and come to Juneau to lobby on various issues. This is one of the issues that's been important to them for several years.
I see. I believe Vice Chair Keller?
Is it safe to say that basically this is a risk management tool that you're saying shall be done? And if it is true, would you describe what it is we're trying to fix, you know, the risk? In other words, what is it that we're trying to control the risk, if you would describe that?
Through the Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, In my belief, it really is a management tool for municipalities. My belief is that as we're looking at a declining budget, trying to make sure that public money is being spent in a manner most efficient as possible, this bill, in my opinion, actually gets us to that point because it makes sure that appropriate qualified professionals are working on projects that are utilizing public funds to decrease the overall construction cost of a project because you're bringing people in that have qualifications in those areas to work on those projects.
Representative Keller.
So, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think I heard you say that it's not a risk management tool so much as it is a way to get efficiency. And then I want a description of what the efficiency is. And I'll tell you what's going through my mind is that it looks like this would be imposed, for example, on all nonprofits who have state money. And I'm aware of a number of nonprofits who, would be very satisfied with fire and safety standards. But the minute that we get into a more stringent standard, I don't see where the efficiency is going to come from. I've seen some nonprofits operating out of stick frame buildings, with marginal appearance, and but the fire marshal and everything had written off on it. I mean, it was fine, but their efficiency would be hard to compare with, like you say, a Taj Mahal that may need to be built. So, I'm just thinking about the I'm a little bit troubled with the mandate in there that they shall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Vice Chair. So the way that I anticipate it actually would work is if you've got a project that has state money in it and you go out and solicit for the design of that facility and you select the most qualified individual, if that's an architect that's used to working on smaller size commercial buildings, that architect can be more efficient with that design than somebody who is working exclusively on other types of buildings that is then saying, I want to enter this market, and they come into the market, but they don't have necessarily the experience in the appropriate codes for the building that's being designed. And so I do believe that there are efficiencies. I do also believe it's a risk management tool as well, because if you have the appropriately qualified designer for a project, then you have less of a risk in having that project either go over budget or be constructed incorrectly.
Patrick Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just still am choking a little bit on the efficiency idea. For the record, I have designed buildings and I have built buildings. And I have built buildings that have been designed by architects, engineers, and what have you. And there's a, like you have pointed out already, there's a huge scope of what the qualifications may be. And what I'm troubled with a little bit, looking at this bill, my initial look is it just seems like if we're in a position, if procurement is in a position where we're defining what the qualifications are, for qualification-based service, then is there not also the opportunity there to mess with the scope of people that may be qualified just simply based on the definition of what the quality is? And I see it as a means that, I don't know how you protect what the evidence-based qualifications are. There's no boards, there's nothing, and it just seems like some of what you're presenting is what I would expect to hear from an engineering company, for example, that I would be hiring for good reason. I appreciate I built a house on a cliff one time, and the engineer is really still there, did a good job, that kind of thing. It isn't that I don't appreciate that, it's just that, isn't there a possibility here that the competition will be diminished and there will be just certain selected approved, government-approved contractors?
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Keller, I do not believe that competition will be diminished. I do believe that most engineers, architects, land surveyors are used to competing for the work. I think it creates a healthy environment for the profession because it keeps professionals making sure that they're doing the work that they need to be doing. If I'm putting in, and actually I haven't practiced design engineering in quite a long time, but when I was, I can come in and say to the DOT, for example, on projects that right now are required to use qualifications, I submit a proposal on a road project that goes back and says, over the last 5 years, I've done these types of roads that are similar to the project you're doing. So I'm going to be very efficient at being able to do that. And because I'm going to be efficient at doing that, I'm actually going to cost less than somebody that might be trying to learn as they're picking up the work, and I do think that in the engineering profession, and I do believe in the architectural profession, although there are architects available to talk about this, that we do have kind of a good mentoring process where, as a young engineer, I was working for other engineers that had more experience, so I could gain that level of experience to be able to bring that to a proposal.
Okay. Anybody else? Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Keto, for being here this morning. On page 2, on line 18 through 21, there is a provision in here that can include price as an added factor in selecting someone, but on line 18 it says, in order for the contracting person to include price as a factor in selection, a majority of the persons involved by the contracting person in evaluation of the proposals shall be registered in the state to perform architectural, engineering, or land surveying services. And I have a concern about school districts or municipalities via the grant process in remote locations. Those are generally done by committee, school board, city council, those kind of things. And I'm not sure how many of those people are available in some of those communities to actually serve as a selection committee. I think of a couple of the communities that I represent. And it might be hard to come up with architects or PEs, professional engineers, or even land surveyors to do that selection. So that almost eliminates them from even considering. I think, at least my first blush, I shouldn't say it does eliminate them, but it's
good.
In some of those remote communities, there just aren't a lot of architects or engineers. There may be some registered land surveyors, and there might be an engineer too, but I'm just not sure they're all on the school boards and the city councils in some of the more remote communities. So I think that probably creates an issue for them to even consider price in a typical procurement thing. I know that we want highly qualified professionals doing our work, but we also want to make sure that everybody wants to get the best bang for their buck, no question about it. I think that might pose a real difficulty in some of those remote locations to actually even have those types of people to help make that decision.
Okay.
Through the chair, Representative Tallarico. So there are two components to my response to that question. The first is, if you are looking at something that is a cost component, typically those are things that would be repetitive in nature, where you're performing the same service. Perhaps that's a structural inspection service or something like that, where you know exactly the types of things that you're going to be reviewing. Or more often it's things like performing surveys, where you actually have number of repetitive surveys that are going to be taking place that can be done fairly efficiently. In those cases, DOT, this is actually language that comes from the DOT procurement law that says that if you are going to do that, then you need to have people that have qualifications as the appropriate design professional on the selection team. So in regard to schools, there is actually current law that requires that school districts utilize qualifications-based selection. And when they do that, they do have their school boards with members. The Department of Education has the opportunity, and I've sat on a few of those selection committees, where we can choose to be engaged in the selection process to help facilitate. And as a design professional, I have done that on qualifications-based projects. And so for schools that are looking at design, typically they will not be looking at a cost type of procurement where they're doing a repetitive item over and over again that would qualify them for doing a cost selection. So they would be doing a qualifications-based selection. The statutes and regulations also provide for schools that want to do alternative procurement if they want to do a design build or a construction manager, general contractor, where there's some combination of design and construction going on at the same time, that the department can engage with the school district to make sure that the technical aspects of that procurement are being done appropriately. So those things, especially for schools, are already covered in existing law. The other side of it really is trying to make sure that there are opportunities where you have a repetitive task, that those repetitive tasks can be done with cost.
Okay. Any response to that?
No. Thank you, Mr.
Okay. Reverend Vasquez, you look like you're finding something there.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to. Yeah, I do have. So, Representative Quito, in a nutshell, what does this bill try to prevent that appears to be a problem to date?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, the concern that I have in putting this bill forward is to make sure that any money that we as a state are putting into public projects is money that's going into a project that's going to serve the purpose as efficiently and inexpensively as possible. So building, say, for example, a community center for a community where the state is providing money, that making sure that facility is being designed and constructed to the point where it's going to serve that purpose for that community for a long period of time, as opposed to in some cases where there might not be as much municipal oversight, that a facility could be constructed that might end up with some failures of construction or design in a shorter period of time.
Follow up?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see that this adds a subsection to the statute. It adds 36.90.110, but the statutory section before it, 36.90.100, addresses contracts for architecture, engineering, land surveying, or landscape architectural services. Your bill seems to omit or delete references to landscape architectural services. Is there a reason for that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vasquez, I don't know if there is a specific reason for that, except that typically projects that are funded from the state of Alaska to a municipality aren't specifically landscape architect projects. They're typically building or infrastructure type projects.
Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
And for the record, what is landscape architectural services refers to?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, landscape architects will be those individuals that work on the grounds around a facility. So the types of vegetation that might be planted, whether it's appropriate for climate or for condition, retaining walls that are less than 3 feet high that create a landscape for the grounds of the facility. So it's the earthwork, the vegetation, it's the things that go into the areas around, say, a building or in open spaces within, say, other infrastructure projects.
Follow up?
Well, I'm going to restate the question. It appears that this new section omits landscape architectural services. So there's no reason for that at this point? Is that an oversight or?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, I don't know specifically that it was omitted but I do know that there are very few grants from the state of Alaska that go specifically to doing the landscaping for a particular facility.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, because the same logic for that is made for the other engineering land surveying services can be said for landscape architectural services if funds are provided. I mean, Arctic climate is going to be different from the southeast climate, which is in a tropical forest. So someone that really doesn't know their vegetation, landscaping could really not perform well, I would imagine.
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, and that is a very important question. I remember when I was first starting out as an engineer, and I remember being directed to the Plant Materials Center to be trying to find landscaping components for the embankment of a roadway and trying to determine which types of vegetation would be best suited for not undermining the foundation but providing cover so you don't end up with the soil leaving, and then also trying to find out whether or not there are native species that can be utilized as opposed to bringing exterior species. Those are all things that landscape architects do pay very close attention to. They will typically work for other design professionals in larger, like, road projects where they're doing the embankment, or in the case of a building, they would be working for the architect. They would not typically be the primary applicant of or proposer on a project.
I'm sorry, I got distracted there. Yes, Representative Vasquez.
So wouldn't it make sense to add it to this particular bill?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, it's certainly something we can look at.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay, go ahead.
The concept appears to be good. How do you provide sideboards so that you don't get carried away and not look at the final price tag?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, I think the biggest thing that we have going for us when we're looking at trying to plan for a project, whether it's a municipality, whether it's the state, whether it's an individual, is making sure that you understand what your budget is starting. And as you start going through the process, trying to do what you can to keep that budget where it's at, and making sure that as you're doing the design work or you're working on the design work, that you're paying attention to the designer, that you budget an amount of money that's available to complete that design, and that you pay attention to the work that's going on so that the budget either is not exceeded, or if it is, it's exceeded for a reason that you're aware of. That's all part of project management, making sure that you're paying attention to the overall process, and those are the best ways to keep the costs down for the project.
Okay, continue.
Mr. Chairman, I'm still not at ease with that. It doesn't seem to be enough of a sideboard. Again, I like the concept of the bill, but I'm not sure that it really has sideboards to make sure we don't disregard the price tag.
We'll get Representative Stutz.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to kind of back up here for a moment. Representative Kito, nice to see you. And you mentioned that most firms or there is a particular mentoring program, because when I first heard this, being from fisheries, I'm thinking, well, how do we get new entrants into doing this? Can you maybe expound just a little bit on this mentoring program? Is it a fairly common thing amongst the architectural firms? Because I would hate to see something exclude others from eventually being able to participate in these contracts from lack of experience when they're unable to get that experience.
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, I can speak specifically to my profession. And so as a graduate with a civil engineering degree, I don't have the ability to hang out a shingle. So in order for me to get to that point, I actually need to be licensed, registered in the state of Alaska as a professional engineer, which I am now. But in order to get to that point, once I get my degree, I need to demonstrate to the board that I've had 4 years of increasing responsible charge, which means I'm working actually underneath an engineer who has to sign off on my 4 years. So it can be one engineer that I've worked for 4 years under increasing levels of responsible charge, or it can be three, four, five engineers that I've worked for on different projects that demonstrate that I've got that additional level of responsible charge. So until I actually get my professional engineering license, I am for at least 4 years required to be working under an engineer that has a license.
I didn't know that. So that was very informative.
I didn't know that either.
Appreciate that.
Just one, Vice Chair Keller.
Yeah, just one technical question on on page 2, line 30. It talks about contracting, I guess, with the regional REAs. Do they do contracts? I don't know how that works.
Through the Chair, Representative Keller, they do on a regular basis. So from my experience working with the Department of Education, regional education attendance areas, the school districts will hire an architect or an engineer to do specific projects. Typically, it would be an architect working on a school project, and those architects would be hired by the REAA board. Would be reviewing the proposals for those architects to do design work on a school.
Okay. Who do we have online here?
We have Dale Nelson from the Alaska Professional Design Council. He's in the Anchorage LIO, and then we have two in the room, Mr. Chair.
Let's do the LIO first. Mr. Nelson, are you online there?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and you're at the Anchorage LIO?
Yes, I'm at the Anchorage LIO.
Thank you. Identify yourself and give whatever testimony you'd like to give, please.
And thank you for this opportunity to address you, Mr. Chair and members of the House State Affairs Committee. And my name is Dale Nelson. I'm a registered professional civil engineer, practiced in the state since 1967. You heard Representative Kidu, it took me 5 years, not four, but it's just my process. So it actually started in 72 with registration. Anyway, I am here with the Alaska Professional Design Council Legislative Liaison Committee. I'm chair of that committee. Every year we visit Juneau to do our fly-in and visit the Hill and the QBS, which is before us, is House Bill 24. It's been one that we've supported for a number of years, and we've spoken to many of you pertaining to this. APDC is a supporter of House Bill 24. And APDC has been in business. It's a nonprofit. For a number of years, starting back in the 1970s, and you heard the membership that Representative Kidu says with its member organizations, and I wear the hat of one of those organizations, American Society of Civil Engineers, ASCE, and we're very active in this, not only from the local, but also the state, as well as the national. I sit on the National Board of Direction for ASCE, but back to the point is APDC has been very involved with the communities, and they represent a large number of licensed engineers, and they've been involved with the University of Alaska and the schools in a teaching program as to understanding the STEM program, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and to bring that forward so that it is not necessarily always applied to engineering, architectural, surveying, but it is some of the basics that we need even in our technical groupings. This bill is needed and as Representative Keto spoke to, there's many things that we as APDC work with the communities. We'll put out an RFP and we'll see that, and it has pricing first and are very heavily involved in the selection process. We'll call them up, talk to them. Just recently we did likewise with the an architectural request requirement that was a state agency. It was with the permanent fund for do some remodeling of their building. And we talked to them, the port facility there in Juneau. We talked to the port director on their RFP. But the point is that we're here to, as an education process, and to bring about the fact that QBS has some real values. And I'd like to, in closing, American Public Works Association, which represents owners for procurement of engineering services, has four bullet points that they use when they bring out is lowers overall costs, promotes technical innovation and quality, benefits small firms, satisfies project owners. And the main advantage of the qualification-based selection is that the design professional and the client work in a collaborative spirit to maximize the quality, value, cost-effectiveness, and usefulness of the final product. And that's what we all are as managers and good stewards of the funding that is provided to the communities and development. And as an engineer and as a registered professional engineer, we are, and one of the oaths that we have is for the health, safety, and welfare of the public. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak before you and ask for your support of HB 24.
Thank you very much for your comment. I know the Vice Chair Keller, I think, has a question. But you've been promoting this bill or similar rendition of this bill over a period of time. Is that correct?
Mr.
That
Chairman.
Is correct, sir.
And why has it never passed? Any idea?
It is an educational process. And APDC, and that's what I was alluding to, is the fact that you are the state procurement code has that requirement, and it's an understanding what QBS does. You know, those questions within your committee, and we want to have this opportunity to talk to and to brief these, but it's an education to understanding what the process is about.
Okay, thank you. Vice Chair Keller.
Thank you. Thank you, Dale. APDC sounds like a great organization. What the question I have, it kind of came to my mind, it was a little bit here. We were talking about design of schools in various places. Does APDC, when you approach a client, do you have like standard cookie cutter type things that, you know, designs that can be used across the state? I know in the Mat-Su School District, we have several designs, you know, that are approved and we reuse them. You know, and I'm not sure to what extent you probably do way more than I do. And I just, is that in the scope of the mission and the in the purpose of APDC to just help us cut costs in that way to standardize some of our plans?
Through the chair, if I may, it is not in our scope to get that far into design or those recommendations. Is our scope is to understand which the school district, whether it is local or rural, is to understand what is the process and the value of looking for a qualified designer. And that designer, you mentioned school, would be an architect, would be the lead with support of structural, civil, mechanical, electrical, landscape architects. That's the whole gamut. And it's, and with the getting the qualification, then that architect sitting down with the school district as to the what is the scope you want, and work towards that objective that you were talking about, sir.
Thank you very much. So if you want to hear me, thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Kathy Renner Fritz,
sir?
You have a question?
Oh, I beg your pardon?
I just have a quick clarifying.
Yes, Representative Sponholz.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Nelson, when you were describing the criteria by which the Design Council recommends or supports quality-based selection process, you said lowers costs, promotes innovation, supports small business. What was the fourth?
Satisfies the project owners.
Thank you.
I had to look at my list. Excuse me, sir.
Okay, and Catherine Fritz, that must be you. Doesn't look like John. So please introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Lynn. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Catherine Fritz. I'm a practicing architect here in Juneau. I've been licensed since 1990. Moved to Juneau as working in an architectural field starting in 1983. So that also demonstrates that it takes a while to become a licensed design professional. I have a couple of comments or summary comments. I believe you probably have a letter that I have drafted in your packet of background information already, so I won't reiterate all of those points. But I wanted to make sure everyone was aware that, one, we have an existing statute about qualifications-based selection, and I think if you line up Representative Kito's proposed legislation along with the existing statute, you'll find significant similarities. In fact, the only significant difference is that we are trying to make sure that the provisions already practiced in state are carried down to municipal levels and to other local units who use state funds. So to me, this is really an issue of fairness. It's an issue of fairness in procurement. The goal in any governmental procurement, I believe, and I've been a government architect for many, many years, is that we want extensive competition. We want open competition. We want it to be fair. We want it to be rigorous. We want it to be appropriate for whatever project that is that the state is funding. And that is true at a municipal level, a federal level. The last few years I've been working on a lot of FAA, Federal Aviation Administration projects, and FAA, if not all, I don't personally know all, but most federal agencies anyway, require qualifications-based selection for selecting design teams. This bill would basically close a loophole. And it's not that this loophole is intentionally trickled down to municipal levels where they say, I'm not going to do this QBS stuff. We're going to bid this stuff. I don't think anybody, the people that I've met along the way these many years, do not intentionally believe that that they're going to do something deliberately to go against existing statute. But what they don't understand the complexities of what you've already heard today, these intricate details of, well, how do you get a design team selected if you don't have a lot of local resources of expertise? And it gets kind of mingled into this idea that design is really just like construction. You know, we just need a school. Give us a price. But in fact, design is not like construction. Design is more of a service than a commodity. So the bill does allow, so when you have a design project that has enough widgets and components that can be counted so that everybody can compete on a fair playing field and say, oh, I can give you a bid, I can give you a price of what will cost for this surveying because you have clearly defined what needs to be done, how many acres need to be be assessed, how many control points there's going to be, where the specific land is, then a price can be associated with it. But typically when you begin a design project, especially if a building project, that's what my expertise is in, you don't know all those things. It's like if you're going to design a small office building for yourself, say, and you just put out a proposal, I'd like a price to design an office building. You got three proposals back, and they varied widely from your team of architects and engineers. And you said, well, I'm just going to take the cheapest one. Then the facility is probably going to reflect the less amount of time that you have to be involved, less opportunity for innovation. For example, did you have the time to sit down and talk about energy standards, what kind of goals and stuff you'd want this building to have so you can keep it inexpensive to operate? No, when you have a bid without a scope for those services, you are going to end up with, just out of a need for a design professional to stay in business, they're going to give you the lowest possible number of hours because they have to make ends meet. And when you are grading them on the price, then they are going to limit what they can do for you. The third, which I think is a really critical piece of this, is that, and it was the point that Dale Nelson spoke to a little bit, when you have a qualification-based selection process, what it is doing is offering an opportunity for collaboration between owner and design team. So you go through a defined process of identifying the qualifications that are important for your project. You select someone, the team that you feel is best. Then you sit down with that team and you negotiate price. So it's not that price is not a factor. It is absolutely a factor. But you as the owner have to sit down and say, well, I had in mind that we would do this many of meetings, that it would take this many a month, that I want you to explore this many concepts. And the designer would say, well, or the owner would say, well, I don't really want you to do that. Or the designer would say, look, we can cut out 3 months and do it this way and save you some money. So it's negotiating, going back and forth, looking at the whole effort, and then you decide on a price. What if you can't decide on a price? What if you are at loggerheads? You simply go to the next selected team and the priority of qualifications. So when you do that qualification selection, you end up with a ranking, 1, 2, 3, 4, however many people, teams applied. You start negotiations with the first. If you can't reach what you believe are fair, clear expectations of both parties, you go on to the second, and that's the team that you, once you get a negotiation, that's when a contract is actually written for those services. So it's a two-step process, and it builds expectations are clear, it builds collaboration, it builds a relationship, and you're able to start your project in a way where the design team will understand what your personal goals are, why you want this building to be energy efficient, why you don't care if it's built out of concrete block or, you know, some other material. That's your decision, architect, but I want to keep this time short. Whatever your goals are, whatever your priorities are able to be discussed during negotiation. So those are the primary reasons: fair, open, rigorous competition. Thank you very, very much for your time.
I'm going to ask for a question in the committee because we're running out of time.
Okay.
Is John Walsh in the audience?
I don't need to testify.
He doesn't need to testify, so you can go on for a moment if you'd like to.
Oh, I think I summed it up. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any discussion from the committee? I just think of one thing. I know we used to say in the Air Force, I don't want to fly any airplane that was designed by the lowest bidder. I think some of them were. Okay, any discussion from the committee? Okay. This is more complex than it actually seemed, so I'm going to hold this bell over.
Thank you, sir.
We meet Thursday. We may hear HAR 3 on post-traumatic stress injury as opposed to disorder. And we have HB 269, Mounted Veterans Affairs Commission, member of the CDVSA. And on Thursday, we'll learn what CDVSA means. And we'll have some governor's department. Thank you very much. Very good meeting today. Thank you.